All right, welcome back to the deep dive, everybody. You guys know how this works by now. You send us something you want to know more about, and we dig in, figure it all out so you don't have to. And today, we're looking at a really foundational case. This is Maher v. People back from 1862, still cited even today.
Yeah, and you know what's so interesting about this case is that it really gets into this question of provocation. Like, how do we think about provocation? How does that affect someone's criminal responsibility? And the case boils down to this question, can, you know, learning about your spouse's adultery, can that actually be enough provocation to reduce a charge, like from assault with intent to kill down to something like manslaughter? It's fascinating, right? Like, how much can the law take those emotions into account?
Yeah,
for sure, for sure. And you listeners, you send us a ton of stuff on this. I mean, we've got case briefs, we've got legal analysis, even just like I think some of our own notes we've taken on this case before. So our job today is really to put it all together and see what we can learn. So let's start with the basics. Like, who are the people in this case? What actually went down?
Okay, so we've got William Maher. He's our defendant. And Patrick Hunt is, well, he's the one who got assaulted. So Maher's charged with assault with intent to kill. But here's the thing. Right off the bat, the Michigan Supreme Court overturns his conviction. They say, nope, new trial, which, you know, tells us something went wrong in that first trial.
Yeah. So what happened exactly? What led up to this whole thing?
Well, it all happens pretty quickly. Maher sees his wife with Hunt. They go into the woods together. Okay. About a half hour later, a friend tells Maher that Hunt and his wife, you know, they've been involved sexually the day before, so obviously Maher's not happy. He heads to a saloon, finds Hunt, confronts him, and then shoots him right in the ear with a pistol. Luckily, Hunt survives, but you know, he ends up with permanent hearing loss.
Oh wow, yeah, that's intense. And so you mentioned that the trial court, like, they had a pretty big role in this, right?
Oh yeah, huge. The judge decides, you know what, we're not letting in any evidence about this whole alleged adultery thing, and that's the main reason the Michigan Supreme Court says, whoa, hold up, new trial.
So the big question then is, should that information, the adultery, should that have been allowed? Like, could it be considered provocation?
Exactly. And you know, if it was provocation, could it actually change the charge, like from attempted murder to manslaughter? And then there's that other question, you know, who gets to decide what adequate provocation even is, the judge or the jury?
Okay, so let's break down this whole provocation thing. What does it actually mean, legally speaking, especially back in 1862 when this case was happening?
So in Maher, right, this idea of provocation is like a way for the law to say, okay, we get it. What you did looks like murder, but maybe it's not quite that bad. You know, maybe it's manslaughter instead. And that's because you were provoked. You acted in the heat of passion, not out of some cold, calculated malice.
Right, right. So are there like specific rules for how this provocation doctrine works?
Yeah, there are a few key things. First off, whatever provoked you, it has to be serious. Like, it's got to be something that would make any ordinary person lose it.
Right.
Second, there can't be a ton of time between the provocation and your reaction. You can't just sit on it and stew, you know? And then the last thing is, the law really wants to separate malice, which is what you need for murder, from that heat of passion thing, which is more about manslaughter.
That ordinary person thing, that's interesting. So, like, the law recognizes that not everyone reacts the same way.
Exactly. It's not about whether you specifically freaked out. It's more like, would a reasonable person put in that same crazy situation, would they have lost it too? You know, it's trying to be a little more objective.
Got it. Got it. So what did the justices themselves think about all this? Like, what was the majority opinion?
Well, Justice Christensen, he wrote the majority opinion, and he's pretty clear. Adultery. That's classic provocation. Yeah. Been recognized in common law forever. He's like, look, we get it. Infidelity, that messes people up. It's a deeply emotional thing.
Like, just hearing about the adultery, that's enough for the law.
Yeah, that's a big part of his argument. He says it's the jury's job to decide two things. One, was the provocation enough to make any ordinary person go nuts? And two, did Maher actually act in the heat of the moment because of that news? He even uses this phrase, the human frailty doctrine, which is basically saying, hey, the law has to acknowledge that sometimes people just break, especially when it comes to betrayal like this. The big takeaway here, the thing that makes Maher so important, is that it's not enough to just have a cold legal definition of provocation. You got to look at human nature, how people really react. And who better to do that than a jury, right? A group of regular people from the community.
That makes sense, yeah. But didn't some of the justices disagree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Justice Manning, he writes the dissent. He's got a problem with what kind of evidence counts as provocation. He's like, hold on, you got to actually see the adultery happening, not just hear about it from someone else. Like, firsthand observation, that's the only thing that should count.
So for him, secondhand information, that's not enough to justify losing it?
Nope, not at all. He's worried that if we start letting people off the hook just because someone told them something, well, then anyone could just go around shooting people based on rumors, you know? He wants to make sure there's actual solid proof, which I think is interesting, right? You've got these super strong emotions and they're right at the center of this legal debate. And it makes you wonder, does this case still have something to say about like how much our emotions should affect how responsible we are for our actions?
That's a good question. Yeah. So beyond the majority and the dissent, I think we also had some concurring opinions, right? Like, what did those justices have to add?
Right. Those concurring opinions, they bring in some extra nuance. Justice Martin, he agrees with the majority, but he's really focused on timing. Like, how soon after hearing the news did Marr shoot Hunt? The closer those two things are, the more believable it is that he acted in the heat of passion. You know, it gets back to that cooling off period.
Right. The more time that passes, the more it looks like you had time to think it over.
Exactly. And then Justice Campbell, he points to Marr's behavior. Like, he was sweating, visibly upset. And Campbell's like, see, that shows he was really worked up, not acting all calm and calculated. Like, his body language supports the whole heat of passion thing.
So with all these different opinions, how did the court actually define, like, a legal test for provocation?
They came up with this two-part test. First, the objective part. Would any ordinary person in that situation hearing about their spouse's adultery, would they get so mad that they lose it? Second, the subjective part. Was Marr himself actually provoked to that point? Like, was he really that enraged?
And did they say who gets to use that test?
Yeah, they're very clear. Both parts of that test, those are questions of fact. So it's up to the jury to decide, not the judge. That's a big deal in this ruling. I mean, this is huge, right? Think about what this means for how trials actually work. Who gets to decide what evidence counts and who gets to decide what it means? It all goes back to this core question of provocation and how the law tries to understand those intense, messy human emotions.
Right. Okay, so let's bring it all home. What are the big takeaways here? Why does a case this old still matter today?
Well, like we said, one of the most important things is that evidence of provocation, it can't just be tossed out. The jury needs to hear it. And that really highlights a big difference in our legal system. The court, they set the rules, the legal principles, but the jury, they decide what happened in this specific case based on the evidence. They're the fact finders.
And that connects to the idea of malice, right?
Yes. If you can prove provocation, it might mean there wasn't any malice aforethought, which is key for a murder charge. If you acted in the heat of passion, the law sees it differently than if you plan the whole thing out. That's what separates murder from manslaughter in these cases.
And you mentioned that ordinary person standard before. Why is that so important?
Because it means you can't just say, oh, I'm super sensitive, that's why I did it. It's not about your personal feelings. It's about what a reasonable, average person would do in that same situation. It's trying to make things a bit fairer.
And the timing matters too, right? That cooling off period.
Yeah, definitely. Even if something really bad happened, if a lot of time passes before you react, well, it looks less like a spur of the moment thing. Like, you had time to calm down. So the longer you wait, the harder it is to say you were still in that heat of passion. I think that's one of the reasons this case is so interesting. You know, it gets into these really deep questions about how our minds work, how our emotions work, and how the law should try to account for all that. It's not just about black and white rules. It's about understanding what makes people tick.
So basically, the jury's got to decide, is this something that would make any reasonable person lose it? And did it happen quickly enough that the person didn't have time to cool down?
Exactly. They're like the voice of the community saying, yeah, in this situation, we get why someone might snap. You know, they're bringing in their own understanding of what's reasonable, what's too far.
Man, this has been a really interesting deep dive, a case from over 160 years ago, and it still has so much to teach us about the law, about human nature, about how those two things interact. So to wrap things up, what's the one big thing you'd want our listeners to remember from Marr v. People?
I think the big takeaway is this. The law recognizes that humans have strong emotions, like jealousy, rage. These things are powerful. And sometimes they can be so powerful that they might lessen how responsible we are for our actions. But it's not a free pass, right? Marr shows us that it's the jury's job to look at each case, each situation, and decide if those emotions were really strong enough, if they were justified, if they explain what happened. It's this fascinating balance between acknowledging human frailty and upholding justice.
I like that. And here's a final thought for everyone listening. How does all this apply today? You know, we live in a world where people get provoked by all sorts of things, not just infidelity. Mm-hmm. So How do modern laws deal with prodigation? How do they try to balance objective rules with those very subjective personal emotions? Something to think about.
Yeah, for sure. Something to keep in mind as you continue your legal studies. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Maher v. People. It's been a pleasure breaking it down with you.
Absolutely. Always a good time. All right, everyone, that's it for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.